IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I have with me Lieutenant General Prakash Menon. And we're going to be talking about the India-China relationship and the future of the India-China relationship, given the turbulent year that we've had on the LAC and the reaction by the Indian government, not just from the point of view of military force, but also economic and other instruments. So General Menon, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you, Manoj.
Okay, so let's just begin with looking at what's happened immediately. For the last sort of commander-level conversation that happened sometime in November, which was the eighth round of talks, we've had no significant change in status quo on the LAC as it was, say, since late August, early September. Both sides seem to be deadlocked. And we're hearing about these sort of disengagement proposals that have been put forward and that are being discussed. I wanted to first get your thoughts on this idea of disengagement that we're talking about, where, you know, both sides sort of step back to a certain distance in certain areas, and there's a tussle over who withdraws where first and what does a withdrawal, how does it impinge on sort of future deployment potentially in the case of a crisis, and the issue of, you know, timing, how much time it takes one to deploy given the differences in infrastructure and so on and so forth. So firstly, I wanted to get your thoughts on the disengagement proposals that are being talked about, given that we don't necessarily know in detail what these are.
Yeah, I think the lack of detail is going to handicap what are the contours of this disengagement proposals. Because what we actually see is people primarily speculating on what must have happened. So I think we keep that in mind. But the fact that we have had eight rounds of talks at the military level, the co-commander level, itself is indicative that there is a process which has political blessing on both the sides. After all, both sides keep emphasizing the fact that political guidance has been given to the military to actually now resolve it. And the problem with this particular framework that the militaries have to sort this problem out is actually follows the China narrative that this is actually not a political problem in the sense that it has been created by military forces in action. And of course, they blame our military for actually forcing the Chinese to take the steps that they have. So they continue to maintain that position. And as regards as to the disengagement, the de-escalation, the fact is that whatever little agreement took place was in the area of Doklam after the incident, before, in fact, the incident had happened. And that actually caused the incident, as we know it, when the CO of the unit went to check about whether the Chinese had withdrawn to where they're supposed to. After that, there has been no agreement which can be described that there has been a de-escalation. And so the dangerous thing is that in certain places, apparently, the forces are in eyeball-to-eyeball situation. And that's definitely something which should be avoided, because fog and friction of such a tense situation can actually explode in ways which we can't imagine now and even be caused by one single person who does something unintentionally. So, but I'm sure that the military commanders on both sides are aware of this possibility. And we presume that one of the benefits of that, those talks, would be to reduce this possibility. But I'm just speculating. But I think this would be the first thing which the military commanders would have attempted to do, that we do not get into a situation where uncertainty, tension of the situation, misjudgment, miscommunications actually trigger a large explosion. So we presume that this sort of whatever steps necessary on this part, and this means that there has to be a constant communication between local commanders on both sides. And I think that probably in some way would have been done, but I must admit that I'm speculating. But the fact is that nothing has happened goes to indicate that something like this would have come. About the larger issue about what, apparently there is no common ground for agreement, because the Chinese would say that you have occupied the Kailash range and definitely you need to vacate from there. We would say that that range is in our territory. So the question of vacation does not arise. And we would maintain that you have changed the disposition in what is disputed territory in DBO, Galwan, the hot springs, Pengang So. So we would actually maintain that you let it go back to status quo ante. And that is where probably the rub is, that who moves back first, what moves back, what needs to move back. These things, therefore, have not found any agreement. And I think in many ways, the talk seems to be stalemated, because both sides have now reconciled to the fact that they would have to spend the winter on the ground. There is no movement of major movement of forces back, although some movement would, I presume, have taken place, because such large forces in certain areas would not have been kept there. They would have been slight, but that again, I'm speculating. But I would think that that would have been done purely from a practical point of view. So both sides now are stalemated in Ladakh. Military talks have made no progress. And it doesn't look like there's anything substantial going at the political or the diplomatic level.
So this is interesting. I mean, the one thing about the fact that these talks are stalemated is, from what we've been reading, of course, and all of this is source-based leaked information. There's nothing official that either government is really saying apart from the sort of standard statements about we are in communication. The principle of whatever this de-escalation or disengagement has to be based on, should it be based on time taken for future deployment? Should it be based on distance that you go back? And I guess in different areas and different terrains, you will have to apply different principles. And I guess that's one of the things that, you know, both sides are still locked in. But I want to move on from that, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the last week or so, right? So we've seen India's External Affairs Minister speaking to the media quite candidly in the last 10-15 days. He had an interview with The Hindu. He had an engagement with the Lowy Institute recently. And he's in his recent sort of comment with the Lowy Institute, he sort of spoke about how the relationship with China is significantly damaged, how the Chinese have given us 5 different explanations as to why they have done what they have done, and none of that really makes sense. I want to understand from you generally, because I know that you watch this, how would you sort of see the Indian government's communication strategy in all of this? I mean, it's been very muddled through the process. Do we now seem to be getting a hang of it?
Well, let's say we are improving in that field, because we couldn't have got worse, because at one point in time, the Indian public and the international public were being informed by satellite warriors, as I described them in one of my articles. And there was hardly any information coming from official sources, and that space was either filled up by, again, people who were inimical to us, or media sources which use satellite photographs to explain to the Indian public the situation on the ground. And I think there was definitely a point in the initial part when we certainly could have done better. But maybe now, things seems to be, at least there seems to be a regular update from the MEA. The foreign minister himself has been active, and he seems to be sending out a message that the relationship has reached a very low level in recent times, and we continue to make efforts to improve them, is the message which we try. But what he's telling is the other message which is given out is that unless this is resolved, it cannot be business as usual. That is also he has made clear. So if we were to tag the Ladakh just to the de-escalation and disengagement, I think, again, we might be making a mistake, because fundamentally, we have to get the Chinese to agree on respecting the agreements which they have signed with us. Unless Chinese, both of us make that statement that that agreement will be respected, which means you cannot mass troops, that is an agreement. So even if we did something and they did not take, they could have told us, you violated the agreement. They did not. They went into a military confrontation. That definitely is a violation of the agreement. So I think it is not just de-escalation, disengagement. I think we have to get them to the larger framework of respecting the agreement.
Okay. One of the sort of parts, and again, this has been in the news for the last couple of weeks at least, and I know that you've again been following this ever since the Doklam episode happened in 2017, is this issue of these new villages that seem to have come up along the LAC, along sort of the China-Bhutan disputed territories, and those then impinge on sort of the tri-junction with India and possibly Indian claims, sort of Indian territorial claims with regard to China. And there's been lots of discussion about how this is again salami slicing in a different format being applied to the land boundaries. I wanted to get your thoughts on this, and also what, how India should be. Firstly, I find it strange that suddenly we've gotten so surprised by this, because I just thought that this was expected after Doklam happened, that these sort of changes in status quo would happen. And I think Xi Jinping had spoken quite clearly about, you know, border security in terms of people on the border. So I'm a little surprised that the people in India were surprised by this. But secondly, how do we deal with this?
So were we surprised? I don't think we could have been surprised at the official level, because the type of activities they have undertaken is they have actually now made another road alignment in southeastern Doklam. Initially, it was West Doklam, which actually could be used as a logistic base for a thrust through Bhutan towards the Siliguri corridor. So basically, it opens up another axis of, you can say, for an offensive. So it is a threatened being. So they have created a threat. They have deepened the threat which already existed. That is point one. Two, even in September, when Mahabalipuram meeting was taken place, the Indian intelligence agencies would have come to know. Because obviously, such activities could not have been concealed from satellite. And therefore, despite that, India has kept silent, like it did to the Western Doklam also, whatever construction has come up, India has just kept quiet. This time also, so in Mamallapuram, we were aware that this construction going on. Our policy was that we not raise the issue, which is what we did actually post-Doklam when the construction took place. But that policy continued, which shows that we acquiesced to China's military occupation of disputed territory. And of course, Bhutan, who has always been a reluctant to confront the Chinese on this issue, kept quiet. And now, when this has taken place, the Bhutanese have denied that it is in their territory. That denial indicates that Bhutan says that no longer is Doklam contest. I mean, that's what it means. And worse is, India has also kept quiet again. Our policy seems to acquiesce to Doklam's occupation, military occupation by the Chinese. The signal that is sent to the Chinese is the same signal which probably also was taken, which probably also emboldened the Chinese for its Ladakh venture. So from my point of view, it seems to be that we are not learning the lessons. It is not that what we can do, it would be impractical to think of launching a military operation to dislodge the Chinese from disputed territory, which is actually Bhutanese. and the what you will achieve are not definitely not worth the consequences. That's not the issue. The issue is India's silence signifies that we are acquiescing to Chinese military occupation of Doklam, to which we objected to initially. Then things changed, and then we had Wuhan, we had Mamallapuram. Now we have Ladakh, and now we still seem to follow the same line. So I do not understand that what the Indian leadership is reading and how they think that the Chinese are going to take our silence. We haven't even protested to the Chinese.
Publicly we haven't even acknowledged to protest to the Chinese. Yeah. Okay, let's come to the piece that you've written in the Deccan Herald recently, talking about the sort of broad strategic shifts that are needed. In that you talk about, one of the operational shifts. I mean, I'll get to the strategic shift. But the operational shift in terms of dealing with salami slicing is by enhanced quid pro quo capacity. Now, again, quid pro quo capacity in terms of, say, when things are between Bhutan and China is very different in terms of quid pro quo capacity when it is along the LSC between India and China. How do we create this capacity?
Well, this is a military capacity which has to be created. We have it actually in many ways. Only we need to sort of reorganize it better. The capacity which we wanted to create was based on the mountain strike call, which I don't think is a good idea. Idea is to have smaller units. And what I suggested in my article is brigade-sized unit, which we can move, air mobile for that matter, so that we can apply it wherever we want it with the shortest possible notice. The problem is that the Chinese can nibble, and so can we. But for the nibbling, you need to be prepared in advance. And I'm sure this must be already done by the Indian Armed Forces, because this has been their bread and butter for a long time. The question is the speed at which we should do it. For example, our occupation of Kailash Range, which is our own territory, took us so long that we were first talking to the Chinese, and the Chinese really was not interested in talking so much. At the moment we occupied the Kailash Range, then talks sort of turned around. The foreign ministers spoke to each other, defense ministers spoke to each other. There was a change. I think we need to know to handle the Chinese. The Chinese recognizes strength. And unless India exercises the power that it has in the Himalayas, and that is not a power which can be just wished away, like people say another 1962 has happened, I certainly don't believe it. We have sufficient military power there, including air power, which cannot be ignored by the Chinese. So the Chinese can threaten us with these large forces, but it will not be easy for them to apply them in the altitudes which we are talking about. And we have much more experience in that altitude than these Chinese soldiers. And if you know about the recruitment policy of the Chinese armed forces, I mean, they have a very short tenure in the armed forces, most of them. So to think that the Chinese have become 10 feet tall, like they want us, everybody to believe, is what something which we understand, and I'm sure the official missionary understands that. So what we have to do is to disabuse the Chinese, that they can threaten us and we will concede or capitulate. And I think that's one of the lessons of Ladakh to the Chinese, that they cannot threaten us with military force and expect that there will be no resistance. I think they took the long lesson from the Doklam.
Yeah.
And that is what I think we have to disabuse. But there again, we're going back because they're doing the same thing in Doklam. And the interesting part was the Doklam intrusion broke into the public arena through a tweet from a Chinese.
Yeah.
So it seems that China officially wanted the world to know that this is what it has done and nobody can do anything about it.
Mm.
And since it is followed by the silence of since Bhutan says it is not our territory and India is silent, then the Chinese message, remember, is not only to us, but to other guys who are watching the Chinese military behavior, strategic behavior, the entire Southeast Asian nations for that matter, would take a lesson from this, that after all, one of the things of the Ladakh is also to show Chinese military power and convey the message that we have arrived, we are strong, all of you guys better listen to us. That's why it has to rise to be at a level of power which all it has to say is, we want this done and you do it. Yeah. The Asian hegemon. So I think India is a unique position to actually at least stop, if not slow down, if not halt, the Chinese advance in this arena of psychological ascendancy.
All right, that's interesting. Yeah, and I think one of the sort of key aspects of, you know, being putting yourself in a position to do that is to obviously cultivate your own national power and cultivate the sort of and sort of develop the means and tools to be able to do that. And in your piece, you talk about how India's national strategy must aim to defend its land borders while maximizing the growth of its maritime power. And, you know, when Jaishankar talks about the fact that the Chinese have given us five different explanations, I guess one explanation that they haven't given but is probably implicit is that we would like you to continue to spend your resources on the land boundary as opposed to developing maritime power, which essentially sort of drains our capacity to constrain the Chinese as they develop their naval power further. But I mean, there is a question to be asked here, right? I mean, how do we go about doing this, particularly when we know that we have serious budget constraints? I mean, even before COVID, I was looking at the numbers for last year, and the last union budget, the Indian Navy was allocated some 41,000 crore rupees as against a projected amount of 64,307 crore. And this budgeted amount wasn't enough to meet its existing committed liabilities. Today, we have reports about, you know, the Navy looking at a third aircraft carrier, yet at the same time talking about cutting down the number of sort of landing docks that it needs for amphibious assault. How do we sort of deal with this challenge? Because this is a real challenge, and you've written about it also, right? Across the board, the budget for our armed forces, a significant amount of it also is earmarked for pensions and manpower expenses. So how do we do this? How do we build this capacity?
I think the political leadership has to now prioritize national security more than what they have done, which means there's nothing you can do except to increase the defense budget. Because you can't expect to become a maritime power of any consequence with the type of budget which has been allocated in the last, even throughout both the periods of this government itself. And there are any amount of graphs to show that how the money for capital budget has been shrinking over a period of time because of, as you said, the pension and so on. While you can't sort out the pension problem and try to do anything, there is no other way but to increase the defense budget, because that is a national security imperative. It is not merely a question of how to balance the budget. If we can spend so much of money on Indian Airlines or so many other projects which have been done, surely national security can be given the money that we want. And by the way, in behind the doors and outside, the political leadership always assures the military leadership, don't worry, we will give you what you want. But that normally doesn't happen because you have to go through the grind of bureaucracy. Finance ministry will come into play. It never happens. I think we need a shift here, because if you don't prioritize the national security, then the Navy will have to do what you want. They'll have to cut on this and cut on that. An aircraft carrier, the naval chief has made it very clear, is an absolute necessity. Unless India wants to think small and be a coastal navy, it doesn't want to actually see that it can spread its power sufficiently in a distance. There is no other alternative to an aircraft carrier. And surely that is an argument which is actually between now within the services itself. But the point is that the contestation really is going to go now more into the maritime domain, and Indian maritime forces, maritime power, if India wants to be anywhere in the global hierarchy, will have to increase, because that is where the contestation is taking place. There is no alternative but to put more money into it. And that's exactly what the Chinese are doing. You have to beat their strategy. Their strategy is spend more money in the Himalayas so that we don't develop into a maritime power. Our strategy is to make sure that that doesn't happen. That is why I always suggest that as far as the Himalayan borders is concerned, 60% of our military power is towards Pakistan. We have these notions of capturing large parts of Pakistani territory, which is actually well past its sell-by date. After all, we're nuclear powers. The type of conflicts that you're going to fight are going to be not the big fight, but it's going to be limited. And therefore, we can certainly shift some military power, in fact, quite a few, from the west to the north. And that should free resources to some extent for maritime power. But that does not mean that you need not increase the budget. After all, the budget as percentage of GDP has been declining for several years. In a situation when there is global, regional, and subcontinental geopolitical frictions, it doesn't make any sense. Unless it only indicates the priority we are giving to national security. And of course, the issues of our procurement system, the pathologies of the Ministry of Defense itself is a separate issue altogether. But the fact is, as far as the political leadership is concerned, they'll have to walk the talk and make the finances available if you want to actually be a player in this game. And this game is going to be the most important game of the century, because in the next 10 years, we'll decide what will be and how will power shift take place, how will power be ordered. So I don't think there is a choice here. It will always be a difficult one because India's economy has been devastated by COVID. But that's the choice that the national leadership has to take, and I hope they do.
Right. Now, and also, I mean, there's no reason why defense spending cannot catalyze parts of economic growth also. We've seen that around the world historically, where increased defense spending by the government has led to the boon and the burst of new technologies, new industries. But then again, that depends on how we open up our defense manufacturing, defense production, procurement, and the rest of it. So it need not necessarily be a strain on the economy if we will increase the defense budget. At present, it's around 2.1% of the GDP, which I'm sure when you ask people, they will tell you that, you know, this notion of you should spend around 2% of GDP. And these are just notions. If your threat perception is far greater, there's no reason why you should not be spending more on that. But gentlemen, I want to get one last thought on the issue of the aircraft carrier. So while it's true that we will need an aircraft carrier if we are looking at ourselves over the next 10, 15, 20 years as a maritime power far beyond our immediate sort of shores, yet if we are dealing with, say, the threat of Chinese presence in the Indian Ocean, should we be spending on aircraft carriers at the moment? Or should we be prioritizing, at least in the short run, more asymmetric sort of approaches? Things like what the Chinese did with the Americans, right? A2AD type weapons development, which is cheap submarines, mines, and the rest of it.
You know, the notion of the aircraft carrier is being shot down on tactical grounds. And one of the arguments is that these sort of big military platforms won't survive the missile age or the age of precision-guided munitions. This is a tactical argument. In fact, we should be concerned that all our civilian facilities are so vulnerable to missiles and precision-guided munitions. After all, the aircraft carrier and the rest of the military instrument is supposed to protect eventually our industrial civilian capacity, including the population. So the vulnerability thing is a tactical argument against the aircraft carrier. That is, let me tell you, the aircraft carrier moves at a certain speed and it can have many devices by which targeting an aircraft carrier may not be that easy. So that's point one. But so that actually is a lower level argument. The major argument, the strategic argument is, if India wants to deploy its maritime forces for whatever reason outside the range of our land air force bases, then aircraft carriers cannot be done away with. Because an aircraft carrier can be used at all levels of conflict, from peace, to show the flag, in disaster management, in rescue. And there is no way that you can actually give the type of air cover to a surface fleet without an aircraft carrier, at least as far as technology is presently concerned. The Navy is asking for a third aircraft carrier. And let me tell you the state of aircraft carriers in the Navy. We've got one now, which is at sea, one in being built for the last 10 to 12 years. Hopefully, a couple of years, it will be launched. And this is the third aircraft carrier which they are asking for. It will come into play around 2032, 2035, depending on so many things. Now, an aircraft carrier is a very high maintenance platform. So if you have three aircraft carriers, you can take it that two of them will be operational. One will be on long refit and maintenance. So the Navy's logic that, considering the visualization of the maritime contestation and the need for our Navy to be active in areas well outside what air power can support it can get from continental India, we definitely require aircraft carriers. And I don't need to have to describe the size of the Indian Ocean itself, the littoral, and of course, even across into the South China Sea. The size of the maritime space therefore demands that at least two aircraft carriers, for a naval guy, you would have said that we should have more, at least is required. Now, China must be a fool to make, if aircraft carrier was not, have this argument that aircraft carrier's time is up and it can be targeted, then why is China actually going to make six aircraft carriers? So the point is, a tactical argument is being used. I mean, you're comparing it with submarines, that we should have submarines. Everything is required. It's a balance between, you need air power, you need air support, you need undersea, and obviously submarines will have to be there. It's not submarine versus aircraft carriers. I think that's a false binary. Therefore, the case for an aircraft carrier, I think, is very strong, unless India does not want to think in strategic terms. Unless India makes tactical arguments, then it's different. And I'm afraid that the people who are actually trying to shoot down are making tactical arguments and missing the big picture.
Right, right. No, that's fascinating. And that's very, very useful insight for anybody who's sort of wanting to wade into this debate. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Manoj.
This was a pleasure. Thank you. And thank you all for listening. And if you'd like to sort of engage with Takshashila much more, you can do that by going on our website and checking out all our courses. Applications for all of them are open right now. General Melon is, of course, the Director of Strategic Studies at Takshashila. So if you're interested in defense and foreign affairs and all those kinds of things about the difference between strategy and tactics like we just talked about, do sign up for those. And you can check them out on our website. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Manoj.
Please consider signing up for Takshashila's courses. Applications are now open and you can apply at www.takshashila.org.in/courses.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.